Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest edition of the OIS podcast series. My name is David Ledesma. I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the OIS, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Jim Henderson, who's Director of Energy Transition at the OIS. Now, for the month of October 2022, we're doing something a bit different. The OIS is running a series of podcasts focused on COP27 and the issues that are likely to be faced at the conference that is being held between the 6th and the 18th of November in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
Each podcast will consist of a number of interviews with authors of the articles in the OIS Oxford Energy Forum number 33, which is called COP27, Refocusing the World on the Energy Transition Agenda. This is going to be published in October 2022. David and myself will both be doing the interviews, and we hope you enjoy listening to them. This second podcast will focus on the challenges that will be faced by three major regions at COP27. We're talking to Mustafa Uki about Africa and Mahua Mukherjee about India, two key demand centres, and Noura Mansouri about the major energy exporter, Saudi Arabia. Okay, so now we're going to talk to Mustafa Uki, who's written an article for the Oxford Energy Forum on the kind of perspective of African countries ahead of COP27. So Mustafa, welcome to the podcast, and let me get straight into it. I mean, how do you see the key issues for African countries at COP27?
Yes, if you look at Africa, the continent itself accounts for about less than 3% of the world's energy-related CO2 emissions. But it continues to be affected by adverse impact of climate change and in a very disproportionate way. In fact, you know, according to the IPCC, Africa is one of the least climate resilient and most vulnerable regions of the world. And on top of that, it is also one of the least prepared for climate change. So the issue of a fair or just energy transition and the fulfillment of past climate finance pledges are key issues for African countries. And these will be reiterated at the COP27, and especially the question of adaptation measures.
Okay, so obviously adaptation, even loss and damage, are key issues for developing world countries, but that all involves climate finance. So how important is the provision of that finance to African countries in particular? And can they do anything to facilitate its arrival?
No, the provision of adequate level of climate funding or financing under, I should specify that, under sustainable terms and conditions are, I mean, this question of funding is extremely important for African countries. But raising this issue of climate financing at every COP without much progress taking place has become a very frustrating, you know, exercise for African countries. And when you look at the severe economic crisis that is presently affecting Europe, which is one of the major sources of climate funding in the developed world, the situation of insufficient climate funding is unlikely to improve in the short or even maybe the medium term. And moreover, if you look at Europe, Europe also has energy transition program that requires significant level of public financing. Now, it's a very challenging situation, but Africa must face the new realities, the new economic and geopolitical realities that have an impact on this availability of climate funding. And the Africa or African countries should look for additional sources of funding that would be from private or private-public sources of funding, and that could be done locally, regionally, internationally, or all together. But to be able to undertake that, it is very important, you talk about facilitating this climate financing, to be able to undertake this kind of change of strategy, it is important for African countries to undertake adequate and timely structural reforms of the country's policy, regulatory, institutional, and governance system. If they want to attract climate funding, you're going to say this is a common feature. Yes, and Africa has faced this type of constraint in the past for, let's say, energy infrastructure project. But within this context of climate funding, this is very important if they want to move forward in terms of energy transition. And sorry if I repeat this, the message, it's not helping to continuously ask for the same thing without any action being taken. It is, in fact, delaying or postponing the whole process of energy transition.
Okay, I mean, another issue that appears to me to be fairly high up the agenda for African countries is the use of hydrocarbons, and particularly indigenous hydrocarbons, both within Africa and for export revenues. And you know, African countries have made a point about this over the last 6 months as Europe has switched its tack from wanting to decline its use of hydrocarbons to desperately searching for new sources of hydrocarbons. Can you tell us a little bit about the African view on the role of hydrocarbons in the energy transition?
Yes, I mean, to answer your question directly, Africa considers that natural gas has an important role in the continent's energy transition, and policymakers in Africa feel very strongly about it. Now, in a continent where about 600 million people have no access to electricity, we'd expect African countries to be determined. And they've made it very clear, I mean, whether it's through the African Union or a different regional institution, they made it very clear that they intend to develop and use their indigenous natural gas resources or reserves. And as you said, you know, this was made clear at the COP26, and the situation, the gas supply situation in Europe has, in a way, gave it a bit of, has in a way affected the whole issue of European decarbonization policy. But that's a different debate. Now, wherever relevant in Africa, because not all African countries have large reserves of natural gas, so wherever it's relevant, you should expect natural gas to be clearly identified as a part of the country's or the relevant country's energy transition, along with the scaling up of renewable energy capacity. And that's another critical part of Africa's energy transition. If I may add one very important point about this issue of gas, I must say that future gas development in Africa or other regions of the world will need to be carried out in a very cautious and maybe with significant effort in terms of carbon reduction efforts, carbon reduction footprints. It's not business as usual, so it is an aspect which perhaps has not been covered, but it needs to be emphasized.
Okay, you've touched on kind of renewables as a route for Africa as well, which leads me to my last question, which is, you know, does the energy transition actually offer any opportunities for African countries, or is it mainly about addressing challenges?
I have to be very clear about this. Just want to make sure that Africa is not resisting energy transition or energy transition pathway. It's just that it is asking for just or fair energy transition, reflecting the conditions in Africa, I said at the beginning. Now, in the long term, if this transition in Africa, energy transition in Africa, is adequately prepared and implemented, and if African countries adjust their expectation and strategies to address today's changing economic and geopolitical reality, this transition will offer them the opportunity to move to more sustainable economic development foundations. These are structural changes that I'm talking about. And this will surely provide these countries with economic and environmental benefit. But, and there is a but, it will require, as I said initially, it will require the political will and courage of Africa policy decision maker to reform their country's investment and financing environment if they want to attract the relevant level of climate funding.
Okay, well, Mustafa, thanks so much for your contribution to the Oxford Energy Forum and also your comments today. It's certainly going to be fascinating to see how many of these issues are raised at COP27, given that it is located in Africa and is being seen as the African COP. But for now, Mustafa, thank you very much indeed. Right now, we're welcoming Noura Mansouri from CAPSARC to the podcast. She's written a fascinating article on the Saudi Arabia's energy transition and its relationship to COP27. So we're going to talk to her about that. Noura, welcome to the podcast. Perhaps I can start with a very general question. How has actually Saudi Arabia's energy transition strategy been progressing since COP26?
Hello, James. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. So indeed, Saudi Arabia's energy transition strategy has been progressing since COP26. With the launch of the first ever utility-scale renewable energy projects, both solar and wind. So we have the 300 megawatts Kaka solar power plant and the 400 megawatt Dawmat Al Jandal wind power plant. With these efforts, Saudi Arabia is on target to diversify its energy mix, shifting away from its reliance on oil toward cleaner energy. As you may know, Saudi Arabia intends to use 50% renewables and 50% natural gas by 2030. The grand plan is to gradually develop over 35 parks across the kingdom using solar, photovoltaic, concentrated solar power, and wind power. Today, 700 megawatts of renewable energy is connected to the grid, and we have about 3 gigawatts under construction. This project will result into 3.7 gigawatt power. It will power 600,000 homes, and by doing so, will reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 7 million tons. Another important progress is that earlier this year, in May 2022, Saudi Arabia appointed its first climate envoy, Adel Al-Jubeir. Is a seasoned diplomat who has been in the Saudi diplomatic service for over 35 years. He previously served as the kingdom's Minister of Foreign Affairs and ambassador to the U.S. He is currently the Minister of State of Foreign Affairs. So the message is clear. Saudi Arabia is taking its climate diplomacy to the next level. This also effectively ends the dichotomy between climate change and hydrocarbons and essentially separates the climate and energy agendas, at least institutionally. Of course, historically, the climate agenda has been managed by hydrocarbons-based institutions, such as the former Ministry of Petroleum and Minerals, which is now the Ministry of Energy, as well as Saudi Aramco. In fact, the shift in rhetoric started a long time ago as the kingdom steadily moved away from its traditional, hydrocarbon-based and defined agenda, pivoting towards a more progressive stance. As the long-standing negotiator representing the Arab League, like-minded developing countries, and G77 plus China, Saudi Arabia had a reputation for obstructing negotiations. However, its stance has shifted in recent years toward a more constructive and even more proactive approach to negotiation.
Great. Well, I mean, what you described there is, quite a lot of initiatives already being taken. And it sounds like Saudi Arabia is now starting to see the energy transition as an opportunity and not necessarily as a risk. Would you say that's true? And what kind of opportunities does it see?
Absolutely, James. So Saudi Arabia last year announced its net zero target of 2060 ahead of COP26 and more than doubling of its NDCs, the nationally determined contributions target, raising it from 130 to 278 metric tons of CO2 per year by 2030. This, of course, is part of the greater Saudi Vision 2030, which details the country's plan to develop a green economy, including its first package of investment of $187 billion. Also last year, Saudi Arabia has launched two major initiatives, the Saudi Green Initiative and the Middle East Green Initiative, to plant 10 billion trees in the kingdom and 40 billion trees across the region. The Saudi Green Initiative alone promises to reduce greenhouse gas emissions globally by 4% per year. And this is at least double Saudi Arabia's current emissions, which is around 1.47% per year. In addition, there's been a lot of progress on hydrogen. So we have NEOM, the futuristic city, with its plans for green hydrogen, which would produce 1.2 million tons of green hydrogen-based ammonia per year. Saudi Aramco is also investing in both blue and green hydrogen. And of course, this is in addition to the world's first shipment of blue ammonia to Japan, which happened in 2020. The kingdom also established the Saudi Nuclear Energy Holding Company, aimed at developing nuclear power plants to produce electricity, but also desalinate seawater and power thermal energy applications. There also has been progress in the Gulf Cooperation Council Interconnection Authority, where the grid is being connected beyond the GCC countries to include regional neighbors like Egypt, Jordan, and Iraq. So this pan-Arab electricity market will be connected to Europe, and this will enable Saudi Arabia to export clean energy, including hydrogen. There's been a lot of collaboration on clean energy with the U.S. and European partners, including with Greece, France, and the U.S. And also, there's been notable progress in economic diversification, where the Public Investment Fund, the PIF's giga projects, including NEOM, the Red Sea Development Project, Amala, and Giddiya, have been progressing to diversify the economic base, but also grow the sustainable tourism sector. Also, shortly after COP26, Saudi Arabia was elected to chair the Adaptation Fund. This is in addition, of course, to its long-standing membership on the Green Climate Fund board. This crowns the kingdom's stewardship and leadership efforts in climate finance on behalf of the Arab League and the like-minded developing countries and G77 plus China, where Saudi Arabia helped secure several climate finance projects in the region, including in Palestine and Bahrain.
Great. I mean, that's a lot of opportunity, a lot of initiatives being taken. But I mean, I guess the fundamental question many people are asking is how the kingdom sees the role of hydrocarbons in the energy transition going forward, obviously as the fundamental underpinning, currently at least, of the economy. So what's your thoughts on that, the future role of hydrocarbons?
Let me first shed light on the current affairs. So the Russia-Ukraine conflict is a grave reminder of the reality of our world today, where climate change concerns lose their salience when countries are faced with a growing need for energy security. The EU, as you may know, has reverted to using more coal to replace Russian hydrocarbon imports, disregarding the COP26 pledge that was 3 months ago to phase down unabated coal and its own EU Green Deal, at least in the short run. Reverting to coal, even in the short term, will likely make it more difficult to reach net zero on time. Also, the EU, along with the G7, had pledged at Glasgow in COP26 to stop financing fossil fuel projects abroad by 2022. Yet with the conflict, it has renewed its negotiations with developing countries for new investments aimed at further exploiting hydrocarbons. This includes Germany, France, and Italy's efforts with African countries. So today, more than ever, collective climate actions must embody sustainability, flexibility, and inclusivity. And the circular carbon economy framework formulated under the Saudi G20 presidency offers the countries that much needed flexibility. So keeping all the energy options open is key for energy security and will support a more sustainable climate action strategy. Of course, Saudi Arabia has maintained its upstream investments, even when others called for a phase out of hydrocarbons, particularly in Europe. This resilient and sustainable investment in its hydrocarbon sector, which has weathered oil prices as low as $30 per barrel, has enabled Saudi Arabia to remain one of the few highly reliable and flexible spare capacity suppliers. So the kingdom maintains that hydrocarbons can continue to be used, of course, with important emission reduction technologies such as carbon capture, utilization, and storage, as well as hydrogen for carbon circularity and neutrality. So for the Kingdom, it's important to recognize the diversity of mitigation options without any bias towards or against any source.
Okay, that's very clear. And so as we go towards COP27, what are the Kingdom's key objectives at that conference?
So in COP26, it resulted in the completion of the Paris Agreement rulebook. Expectations for COP27 include making progress on operationalizing Article 6. There has been significant progress on operationalizing Article 6 during the June negotiations in Bonn. Some challenges are expected regarding non-market approaches and what to include in COP27. Developing countries, of course, would like to see the full implementation of Article 6 as soon as possible. On the transparency agenda concerning the reporting on climate action, it was completed at COP26 with the operational guidance for reporting on action and support perceived to be balanced. Negotiations on the remaining minor issue concerning the voluntary review of adaptation in Article 13 started in June in Bonn, and a decision should be adopted at COP27. On the global stocktake, of course, COP27 will continue the preparation of the global stocktake, which will take place at COP28 in the United Arab Emirates in 2023. On the climate finance agenda, of course, developed countries must honor their promise and deliver on the commitments they have made. So this must be addressed at COP27. The failure to fulfill the promise of $100 billion a year from 2020 for climate mitigation and adaptation to be provided and mobilized by developed countries to help developing countries to develop climate change impacts already being felt to adapt to it, such as floods, heat waves, and storms. So for Saudi Arabia, it is important to honor the Paris Agreement and not deviate from it. This will continue to be an important message.
Okay, Noura, well, look, thank you very much indeed for your very clear answers on Saudi Arabia's viewpoint around the transition in COP27. Thank you also for your very interesting article in the Oxford Energy Forum, which is out in October. Thank you very much.
Now we are welcoming Mahua Mukherjee to the podcast, and she's going to talk about her article in the OEF, India at COP27. Mahua, great to have you here. Now at COP26, it announced a net zero target and goals for increasing new renewables. Can you tell us what progress is being made on these?
Hi, David. Great to be here. India's renewable journey is progressing well, considering that it's entirely self-financed through the public budget and commercial debt and equity. So today, around 25% of India's installed generation capacity is renewable. And in August 2022, when India submitted its updated NDCs, it committed that non-fossil fuel generation sources will actually go up to 50% of installed capacity by 2030. So that means doubling the share of renewables in just 7 years, which is a huge stretch. Even more so because installed capacity itself will also have to increase a lot in order to meet India's economic growth goals. So it represents a large addition of renewables in the rest of this decade. And you also asked about the net zero target. That remains in place for 2070. The government's priority is to focus on tripling per capita income in the next 3 decades, which will require around 8 to 9% economic growth per year. In 3 decades, so around 2050, today's cutting edge technologies will hopefully be mainstreamed, including carbon capture and storage. And if the technologies are abundant and affordable and in widespread use by then, it'll help India to adopt them in a big way to achieve net zero over the subsequent 2 decades after 2050, taking it up to 2070.
Well, Mahua, let's talk for a minute about the Russia-Ukraine war. Has that and the current state of the global energy market changed India's views on the energy transition?
Yes, it has. In 3 respects, it's changed India's views. That would be on the role of gas and the role of coal, and thirdly, on the importance of storage. So let me start with gas. India is watching natural gas prices go through the roof since the second quarter of this year. Prices are far higher than consumer tariffs could hope to recover in the domestic market without heavy subsidies. So it basically means that gas is not really affordable any longer as a mainstream fuel. Also, gas shipments are being diverted to Europe as it's more lucrative for some suppliers to pay fines and default on cheaper, previously contracted long-term rates. So the role of gas as a bridge fuel requires a rethink in India, although sadly the government has already spent billions in public funds laying trunk pipelines all over the country, and it's also in the middle of building LNG import terminals. So that's a rethink on gas. Secondly, on coal. So coal prices have also gone through the roof, as India found out when it had to import fairly large quantities due to a record prolonged heat wave earlier this year, and found itself in direct competition with European and Chinese buyers. The historical emitters from Europe have demonstrated that energy security trumps all else by their embrace of fossil fuels, despite these scientific findings in IPCC reports. It's really an emperor's new clothes moment regarding the truth about renewables without sufficient storage capacity and transmission capacity. Renewables alone are simply not ready for prime time yet, because without storage, they can't offer what fossil fuels can. I suspect because of the international energy market developments of 2022, India may likely feel under less pressure to prematurely shut down its fleet of newer coal plants, which was being discussed earlier. Third, on storage technologies, these are still unaffordable for India and inaccessible in the amounts required throughout the electricity network. It was certainly striking that countries which are normally hailed as world leaders in renewable energies and who've been the strongest advocates for developing countries to leapfrog and rely on renewables, interestingly enough, chose not to do so themselves. Instead, they jumped back to fossil fuels in the blink of an eye, citing the infirm nature of renewables. They also stated that renewables would not suffice to keep factories and businesses running and protect against job losses. But this was, of course, not news to India, which has been saying exactly this for quite some time. I'd still say that these delicate points spilling out into the open has been an instructive experience for India. When you ask about whether India's views have changed this year, they certainly have.
Okay, Mahua, so how do you think India currently views the current COP process? And what do you think are the likely key objectives for COP27?
Well, I think everyone's aware that at COP27, both multilateralism and solidarity on financing the energy transition are both likely to be in very short supply. Developed country priorities have drastically changed since COP26, regardless of the often cited earlier so-called doomsday predictions. So as far as India is concerned, the cost of capital is a long-standing important objective of India's. It's well known that solar and wind investments are only cheaper than coal if the cost of capital for the upfront investment in the technology hardware is concessional. If the clean energy generation tariff has to be set high in order to recover high debt service payments or intellectual property protection costs, then the clean energy can't be sold cheaply to the end user, and it defeats the purpose in a low affordability country like India. So India will be looking for clarity on the developed countries' intentions regarding the cost of funding, as well as a commitment not to add expensive licensing fees, royalties, or other cost-increasing intellectual property protections. If there is no satisfactory outcome, then it's fair to assume that India would not be interested in such arrangements that just serve to raise the cost of clean energy for its consumers. It's likely in that case that India will instead look for homegrown energy transition and pursue it as it's doing today, however long that takes. And there's one more very important and key objective that India is likely to have at COP27. The global carbon budget is one issue that I bet India probably never previously thought it would have to worry about. Yet, this issue has alarmingly come to the forefront now, evident in the developed country's tendency to grab the planet's tiny sliver of remaining carbon budget. And lastly, I'd say another key objective for India will be to see, at the end of the COP27 event, whether there is anything resembling an international agreement anymore. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, Mohan, well, let's just finish up, if we can, by asking about Prime Minister Modi's view, because he's demanded significant financing to help India achieve energy transition goals. So do you think this is going to be a major issue for India at COP27?
I think it is, probably in the following way. Last month, a major international study pointed out that India needs $170 billion per year to achieve its NDCs. The study noted that India on its own has mobilized about $44 billion per year for clean energy investment. But that's only a quarter of the $170 billion that's needed to fulfill the NDCs. And Bloomberg's figure is $30 billion per year, but that's only for India's large-scale solar and wind targets. So nobody has yet included any storage technologies or transmission upgrades or natural gas infrastructure or green hydrogen infrastructure, which are all part of the broader Indian energy transition plan, but not necessarily just for the NDCs. So clearly, the Indian delegation is going to wonder, are we going to be remaining with our quarter of the available required money, or are we going to get any more? And it's not really, the expectations are not really very high. So when someone wonders how India is getting on with its renewables, the more useful question to ask would actually be, what progress is India making with self-financing its renewables on commercial terms? Because that is exactly what's happening at the moment, and it may be likely to continue for some time. And the answer to that is that India has been able to assemble a quarter of the funds it needs, and it's moving accordingly.
Well, Mohan, thank you so much for your time and indeed your views today, and look forward to speaking to you again soon. Thank you.
We would like to thank all our interviewees for their time and their excellent contributions to the October 2022 edition of the Oxford Energy Forum, which is called COP27, Refocusing the World on the Energy Transition Agenda. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.